This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
And welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather round the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. We're going to focus on Iran for the better part of this program tonight. Coming up very shortly, a regular feature with the discoverer of reverse speech, David John Oates. He's standing by live from Australia with some interesting reversals on U.S. officials or from U.S. officials concerning the recent events involving the conflict with Iran. Then towards the bottom of the hour, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis will be here to discuss Iran. Was it a good idea, in his estimation, for the U.S. to target Qasem Soleimani? We'll talk about certain rumors floating around concerning what Soleimani may have been up to when he arrived in Baghdad. And we'll also get into the horrible situation, the downing of the Ukrainian airliner killing all 176 aboard, including 57 Canadian citizens, by the Iranians. That conversation will take us up to the top of the hour. And then in hour two, open lines. And I'm not going to limit the conversation to Iran, but I'm guessing many of you will have lots to say on the matter. Although for the time being, thank God, things seem to have quieted down. I'm not sure if you recall a few weeks ago on this program, one of the last, if not the last, programs of 2019 during Open Lines, I offered up several of my predictions for 2020, and I predicted regime change in Iran. I predicted that the mullahs, the Islamic clerics that rule that country, and the Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, would flee the country. What do you think of that prediction now? Well, we'll discuss during the open line portion of the program, that and, of course, anything else you care to discuss. Open lines in hour two. Owen Wolf is my technical producer. He also answers the phones for open lines. And Ryan White is my live stream producer. And yes, we are live streaming audio on the YouTube channel Strange Planet. Over the last several months, David John Oates, the discoverer of reverse speech, has joined us. The second show of every month in the first hour, and he's revealed the inner thoughts of the unconscious mind of hardened criminals, celebrities, historical figures, politicians, and in so doing has revealed on this program some pretty startling findings. He is, of course, with us again tonight, and I gave David an assignment earlier this week. I said, David, let's see if you can find any interesting, telling reversals from any U.S. politicians or intelligence or military people, cabinet secretaries, etc., relating to the recent events in Iran. And as always, David went to work, rolled up his sleeves, and poured through or went through hours of audio from press conferences and interviews. And he's here right now with the findings. Now, I haven't heard any of these. I don't know anything about what we're going to hear. I don't know who we're going to hear from. So this ought to be real interesting. David is, I say, the discoverer of reverse speech. He's the author of several books on the topic, including It's Only a Metaphor, Beyond Backward Masking, Reverse Speech, A New Theory About Language, and Reverse Speech, Voices from the Unconscious. He's also the co-host of the podcast, Reverse Speech Radio. David, how are you?
I'm doing great, Richard. How are you in this new year, 2020? Here we are.
Yes, indeed. Hard to believe. Now, I got to ask you, before we get rolling with Iran, have you been affected at all by the wildfires where you are?
Well, not personally. No, no. I'm in the city of Adelaide. We've got some fires in the hills, but around Adelaide City, but I'm in the suburbs. But the real threat is on the east coast of New South Wales and Victoria.
They're,
although Kangaroo Island, which is just 100 miles south of me, is half gone. I mean, just tragic. I went camping there just last year on Kangaroo Island. Beautiful place. Can't believe it's half gone due to fires and the loss of property and human loss. That they estimate $500 million wildlife have been lost.
That's just staggering, staggering. But you're finally getting some rain, I understand.
Slowly. Temperatures are down a little bit today. You know, we'll see. It's not enough yet, but we've got some. But
and what did you make? Maybe you can maybe confirm what maybe something that you've heard. We've been hearing about climate change and how this was the result of climate change for so long, and then we're starting to hear about all of these arrests for arson in Australia.
Yeah.
And some have tried to deny it. They say, well, that was Twitter bots or something.
Fake
news.
They've arrested 80 people so far for deliberately starting fires. Oh no, this has been majority of these fires are arson. It's not climate change. Sorry, to disappoint folks on that one.
No, I wasn't. I can't say that I was shocked. Have you read anything in the Australian or heard anything in the Australian media about motives? Did these people want to? Were they trying to? To try and, you know, get people to think that it was climate change? Were they climate change activists? Who are they?
No motives. No, I haven't seen anything about it. All I know is there have been 80 arrests for deliberately setting fires. That's all I know.
Right.
How can anyone do that? I mean, I just don't understand the mentality that can even think about doing something like that.
No. And the foreign firefighters starting to arrive. I saw the reports of the
That's
U.S.
right.
firefighters and so forth.
That's right. Yes. Yes. Well, Australia's firefighters are stretched to the limit. I mean, you know, all our resources are maxed out. We need all the help we can get.
Yeah. Yes. Well, let's hope that rain continues to fall.
Yeah, it's a great tragedy for Australia. It really is.
Well, on to from one tragedy to another, and these recent events, things seem to have simmered down somewhat between the United States and Iran.
Yes, they do. I was half expecting all-out war to break out when Iran started firing missiles at U.S. bases in Iraq, but it didn't. And Trump didn't respond, well, at least not militarily. He responded with sanctions. So I found some interesting reversals on the whole thing. I'm only just sort of looking through them now. It seems that the U.S. administration thinks they make the wrong decision, which I'm surprised about because I would have thought they were quite sure. So let's look at one on Trump that talks about this. Here he is talking. That justifying the killing of Soleimani?
Yes.
Here we go.
We have the best intelligence in the world. If Americans anywhere are threatened, we have all of those targets already fully identified, and I am ready and prepared to take whatever action is necessary. And that in particular refers to Iran.
Okay, so he's speaking quite strong. But backwards, he says, error, we serve you.
Error, we serve you. Error, we serve you. Error,
wow.
We serve you.
So that's strange.
That's crystal clear. That's a grade A reversal. Yes, error, we serve you.
Yes, it is. So what's the error? And, he's speaking quite strongly forward, you know, about taking military action. But backwards, we're serving an error. This is not something we should be doing. And they did not respond to the attacks.
Now, the timing here would be important to know that this speech that he gave, this was after killing Soleimani, but before the Iranians fired the missiles at the U.S. bases.
Exactly correct. Yes.
Well, maybe subconsciously or unconsciously, he just had doubts because it was a bit of a gambit. When you think of it, because we're told that previous administrations, or at least Susan Rice, she was National Security Advisor in the Obama administration, when she was asked, you know, why they didn't take out Soleimani, they said that they thought it was too big a risk. Although I've heard that they simply didn't have the intelligence. I've heard from other sources that they didn't have the intelligence. They weren't able to, you know, to locate him when they needed to. So I don't know. It was a big risk.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
Trump just had some, his advisors were saying, let's do it. And he was saying, geez, I don't know, this is risky. And then after he did it, he goes, oh boy, you know, he's on tenterhooks.
Yeah. I kind of get that feeling from the reversal. And here we have one. I really have no idea how to explain it, but maybe your guest after me can shed some light on this one. Here he is talking about the killing of Soleimani.
Soleimani has been perpetrating acts of terror to destabilize the Middle East for the last 20 years. What the United States did yesterday should have been done long ago. A lot of lives would have been saved. Just recently, Soleimani led the brutal repression of protesters in Iran, where more than 1,000 innocent civilians were tortured and killed by their own government.
And here he says that the British hit us.
The British hit us.
I don't know. Oh,
the British hit us.
I know. Hang on, look. Let me just play that again. I actually heard that a bit differently this time. I actually heard the British shared us that time.
The British shared us.
Okay, then that makes sense. It shared us. I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, they obviously shared information with the British.
Right. Huh.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
So what would we call that? Would we call that affirmation or?
Yeah, that's what we call an expansive reversal. It gives us extra information. The British were involved in sharing intelligence, I would imagine. Okay.
Right. Okay.
And
who else do we have?
Oh, okay. Well, I got a few more on Trump, but let's look at some others. Here we have, let's look at Pompeo. I'll play this Pompeo one. This is also about the British too. It's Pompeo saying Iran will not get nuclear weapons.
And most of what you suggested in his text message or email or message that you laid out there was indeed Iranian propaganda. It's not new. We've heard these same lies before. It's fundamentally false. He was not there on a diplomatic mission.
Okay, now this is a bit of a metaphor. December Limey urges them. Now, Limey is slang for a British citizen. Limey, a pomp.
Right.
December Limey urges them.
December Limey urges them.
Oh, clear.
December Limey urges them.
That one's very clear.
December Limey urges them.
Okay, I think something happened in December. Some sharing of information with the Brits. I think the Brits were involved in pushing them. I've just been informed the Brits have sent a nuclear sub to Iranian waters.
So it sounds like Pompeo is saying in December they received some information.
Yes,
about presumably Soleimani from British intelligence.
Correct.
Okay, Limey.
Exactly.
That's interesting. Why he would use that's a rather antiquated.
Yeah, I know. Well, use that too. I know.
But it's interesting because the forward speech has more to do with Well, it was. It has been alleged by a number of sources that the Iraqi prime minister claimed that Soleimani was in Baghdad not to plot, you know, more terrorist actions, not to blow up the U.S. embassy or target more U.S. Army personnel. He was there at the behest, perhaps, of the Americans to de-escalate the situation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And so in the forward speech, Pompeo was just dismissing that outright.
Yeah, Wally, he may say, look, we had British intelligence. The British urged us to go ahead with this.
Yeah. Right. Fascinating. Okay. What's next? Great job, by the way, David. Great job, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Here's a Debbie Wasserman Schultz saying Trump killed Soleimani because of the impeachment.
Donald Trump was just impeached a week and a half ago.
Here he says, she says, there's so much blood.
There's so much blood.
There's so much blood.
Oh, yeah. Ooh.
There's so much blood.
Ooh, that's a curdling sound, isn't it?
Rather, yes. Yes. Okay, so what does that tell us? There's so much blood. Well, that's...
Oh, it just makes sense. You know,
yeah, it makes sense. That. But you said something, she said something about impeachment.
Yeah, oh, she's talking forward. What she's saying is the whole context of the conversation was Trump killed Soleimani because of the impeachment to draw attention away from it or something.
Ah, right, right. Okay.
Now, here we have an interesting reversal. Actually, we'll have I've got a couple of them. Mark Esper, Defense Secretary.
Yes.
So here's the forwards.
Soleimani was caught red-handed on the ground in Baghdad. One terrorist leader of a terrorist organization meeting with another terrorist leader to synchronize and plan additional attacks on American forces, diplomats, or facilities. I think we took the right action to remove these players from the battlefield.
Okay. Now, here we have a metaphor. I'll play it and I'll tell you what it means. See Lucifer Sam.
See Lucifer Sam.
Okay. Sam is a common metaphor for the United States, Uncle Sam.
Right.
See Lucifer Sam. Like, it is aggression, anger, power, a negative metaphor. It seems to mirror what Trump said about an error. And Mark saying, gee whiz, we're getting a little bit aggressive here. Okay.
Interesting, so, because of course Iran refers to America as the great Satan.
Right, right, I know. But here they're putting it back on he's actually confirming it in his verse, which is interesting.
It is interesting.
Anyway, some interesting findings.
I'll say.
Here's a straightforward one.
Secondly, I'd like to say to our service members and our diplomats in the region that we have your back. We thoroughly support what you're doing.
And here he says, yes, a killer.
Yes, a killer.
Yes, a killer.
Yeah.
Yes, a killer.
Yeah, I guess he's referring to Soleimani, Mani, Mani, however you pronounce it.
Right. Okay. Yes, a killer. Well, not much question about that. So we get it. It's kind of a mixed bag here, isn't it? On the one hand.
Yeah. There was some doubts. I can tell you that. Okay, what I can – I mean, I've still got more reversals to play if I've got time. But what I'm conscuring from all of this is there's some doubt about the action. They were pressured by the Brits, okay, and or maybe pressure's too strong a word. Information was shared with the Brits, although urges them is pretty strong, isn't it?
So, right, well, yeah, yeah.
Yes, interesting bag. And here we have Mark Esper again. Here we go.
The commanders in the region, and I should say globally, are taking all appropriate force protection measures.
And here he simply says they broke the law.
They broke the law.
They broke the law. They broke the law.
I guess he's talking about Iran.
Presumably. Well, you and I have been doing this for a while, and I've heard, you know, probably 100 reversals or more from you by now, more than that, probably hundreds of reversals. I don't ever remember them being this clear, this grade A.
Yeah, they're pretty good reversals. Yeah, they certainly are. And I must say, I had some help with these with one of my analysts, Naomi Longson, found some of these. So
please pass along my thanks to Naomi, because you've done a great job here. I was a little bit worried I might have put you on the spot, but you rose to the occasion.
Well, I've always come through for you, Richard.
You have, and you always do. You always do. Well, but the thing is, you could go through hours and hours and find nothing, right?
No. Yeah. Look, I was doing a Trump speech last night for the show today, and it was a half an hour speech, and I found one reversal that wasn't even clear enough for airplay, you know. So
there you go.
It gets frustrating sometimes, you know. You've got to spend a lot of time with the headphones on. But, yeah, you know, look, it all pays off, you know, and we always get great results. And, you know, I hope that in all the shows I've done with you, people are starting to see that there's something to this.
Well, based on the feedback, people are absolutely enthralled, David. We have time for a couple more.
Yeah, okay. Here we have Debbie Wasserman Schultz again.
Allow Ukraine to interfere in the presidential election in 2020. That's outrageous, and I think that has a lot to do with what this attack was about.
And this one says, definite rape.
Definite rape.
Yeah, she feels it was an attack. It was a rape. Okay?
All right. So, and again, trying to tie it to the impeachment.
That's right. Yeah, right. You're exactly right. Yeah. Here's Trump. That one's already open. I thought I didn't play that.
Soldiers back home, I will say that we have had tremendous support from the people of Iraq.
Here he says, it's an ambush.
It's an ambush.
Well, it was an ambush, wasn't it? That's how they killed him.
Right.
So that's just straightforward, really.
Now, I know you don't speak Farsi, but it would be interesting to hear some Iranian reversals.
Oh, I know. Well, see, this is where we need a whole bunch of people of bilingual to get involved in reverse speech. You know, it's unfortunately it's still such a very young field. You know.
Well, eventually you'll have proteges all over the world, and you could reach out to them with a call. You know, you'll have an Iranian bureau and a Japanese bureau, and you'll be able to call, and they'll do the reversal, and you'll have the result. Now, if you did a reversal in, I think I've asked you this before, but just remind me. Now, let's say someone is speaking Farsi, and they do the reversal. The reversal would also be in Farsi, presumably, or would it be in English?
No, with they're speaking, okay, if they have some knowledge of English, you will get a few reversals in English, but the main reversal will be in Farsi. It also depends on how well they speak the second language, is how many reversals that you'll get in that language.
Right. And is it, if you were fluent in another language, David, and maybe you are, I don't know, but if you were, let's say you spoke French, I mean, are you getting the same quality reversals in another language?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Look, there's still got so much more work to do in that whole area, you know, but yes, we are. We're also finding the same metaphors in other languages too. So,
I guess they're universal, aren't they?
Yeah, I believe we're tapping into a universal collective unconscious. You know?
David, outstanding job. Again, Reverse Speech Radio. Still, you've been in hiatus for a little while. Is that's coming back?
Yes, that's coming back next week. Yes.
Oh, excellent. All right. So
in hiatus over the Christmas New Year period.
So. Okay. So reversespeechradio.libsyn.com. reversespeechradio.libsyn.com, or they can go to reversespeechradio.ca. Sorry, reversespeech.ca, and just scroll down and you'll see an old radio. Just click on that and it'll take you right there. David, thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it, mate.
We'll talk next month.
All right. Bye-bye. See you.
Bye-bye. When we come back, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis will reveal what he believes is going on in Iran. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show right after this.
Providing the evidence and letting you draw your own conclusions. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back.
retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis graduated from the U.S. Military Academy, the Naval Postgraduate School, the Command and General Staff College, the Defense Language School, and the Army War College's Strategy Course. He's an airborne ranger, infantry officer with service in four infantry divisions on three continents. Once retired from the U.S. Army, he joined the Family Research Council, where he rose to be the vice president for policy before returning to the Pentagon 16 years ago. He's the author of Future War, The Deeper State, Alliance of Evil, and his latest, Progressive Evil. Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Richard.
Right out of the chute, I'd like your take on the actual targeting of Qasem Soleimani. Was it a good idea or was it ill-advised?
We've been trying to kill Soleimani for a long time, we and the Israelis and others in the region. This, because of his higher profile recently and some pretty bad operational security on his part, we picked up his trail. We tracked him as he left Damascus and flew to Baghdad. There were evidently informants that told us that he was boarding the Cham Wings Airbus A320 at a particular time and would arrive in Baghdad. That alerted people on the ground there in Baghdad to, you know, watch where he got into a car and the path of that car. It would appear that, like other places, we had a drone that was prepared to track the car. And at the appropriate point when they were in a deserted part of the airport leaving for Baghdad, four Hellfire missiles rained down on two vehicles, destroying both, and he was inside of one of them.
There are so many conflicting reports. It's hard to separate the wheat from the chaff. But let me throw out a couple of scenarios that have surfaced. One is that Qasem Soleimani was in Iraq on a peace mission. And this apparently has come from the Iraqi prime minister, who said that Soleimani came there to de-escalate the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I believe the prime minister was also quoted as saying he came there at the United States' behest. And Pompeo, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has completely dismissed that. Have you heard those reports, and where would that come from? Did the Iraqi prime minister say that?
No, I doubt it. Of course, the Iraqis in that particular culture will say one thing and then behind the scenes say something very different. That reflects what President Trump said the other day. You know, the modus operandi of Soleimani was, you know, to instigate insurgencies around the world, mostly in the Middle East. He trained, you know, Yemeni Houthis. He trained, obviously, Hezbollah. He worked with a number of allies in Syria. Obviously, the Shiite and militias and in Iran or in Iraq and elsewhere. I would completely reject out of hand any suggestion that he was a peace emissary. You know, that's not what this man did. He was the second most powerful man in Iran, did the bidding of the Grand Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and did things in a way that would not suggest that he was ever interested in anything other than the expansion of the Shia crescent all the way to the Mediterranean and the destruction of Israel.
The contrarian point of view that has also come out is that he was there possibly to target the U.S. embassy again, but also it has been suggested he may have been there to stage a coup against the Iraqi president. Have you heard that?
Yeah. Certainly the Iraqis have not had terribly stable governments, and we saw, you know, the real divide a week ago when the parliament met, only the Shia showed up, the Sunni and Kurds stayed home, and then they, of course, voted on a non-binding resolution to dismiss the U.S. from Iraq and ask them to leave. And, of course, the prime minister is promoting that idea. The idea that Iran could go in and foster a coup is not out of the question, but I don't think that you would find the Sunnis and the Kurds sitting by more. And keep in mind, a lot of the Shia there are truly Iraqi patriots. They will take some assistance from Tehran, but they don't like to be told what to do by that outside power.
We're told that Soleimani had been targeted in the past by previous administrations, the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration. But they never pulled the trigger because they were fearful, I guess, that it might ignite some more widespread conflict. So why now?
Well, I would argue that under Bush and under Obama, the intelligence on Soleimani was not always that good. He is a master of deception and a master of keeping a low profile. But at age 62, apparently over the last year, he has become incredibly bold and, you know, even giving interviews. And his whereabouts was much easier to track, as evidenced by the takedown last week. So, you know, it's an interesting theory. I don't embrace it.
What do you say to the critics who say Soleimani was fighting ISIS? He was fighting ISIS in Syria. He was fighting ISIS in Iraq. Sometimes, you know, the enemy of your enemy is your friend, and we've made those sorts of bargains in the past. What do you say to them that why would we target someone who's killing ISIS?
Well, I agree he was killing ISIS. And, you know, one of the things that President Trump said at his speech on Wednesday morning this past week was that, you know, we should be working together. And he made a reference to the ISIS fight. But at the same time, keep in mind, you know, that they're pushing against very important interests that we have in the region. You know, they arm and foist Hezbollah to keep the pressure in the north of Israel. They arm Islamic Jihad and Hamas out of Gaza, and there's a constant flow of terrorists, obviously rockets from that area. They foster and supply the Houthis that keep the Saudis on their toes. And of course, they are constantly harassing shipping in the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, as well as the Strait of Hormuz. And then, of course, what they're doing as well in Syria and Iraq. So the whole idea that we could work with them, yes, we could, if they would stop, as President Trump says, doing all the rest of this stuff. And, of course, they're even in our own hemisphere, and in Venezuela, Nicaragua, a few other places with Hezbollah, and they're, of course, earning money through drugs, but they're also training people to do things that we don't appreciate. So, yeah, I buy the idea, but I reject it primarily because there isn't sufficient evidence that they would back down from doing the other nefarious things they're guilty of.
I was watching Tucker Carlson not too long ago, and he made, I thought, was a very valid point. I'd like to get your feelings about this, your thoughts. Why should we trust the intelligence that says one thing or the other when just, you know, for the last 2 years, we've been bemoaning the fact that the intelligence apparatus has been used in what one might describe as a soft coup attempt against the president?
Yeah, I do listen to Tucker as well, and I understand the concern there. And it has been, obviously, the law enforcement, and some people would argue that even the CIA was culpable in helping to feed the Russian hoax and this a number of other scandals. I would argue, though, that when we're talking about the type of intelligence that is involved with regard to the likes of Iran, North Korea, and China, not as much Russia, that you know, the president who gets briefed regularly and the people that operate based upon that intelligence have found it pretty reliable, in spite of, you know, the portion that you articulate as being, you know, sort of out of control. It doesn't mean that it couldn't be misused, but I suspect that we're watching close enough and don't believe that it was misused in a way as we've seen in the past.
All right, Bob, just hold on. We'll take a quick time out, come back. We'll talk about the downing of the Ukrainian airliner and more. Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Take a look around. What do you really see? This is where you can tell all about it. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis is with us here on The Conspiracy Show. The retaliation from the Iranians and the targeting of two military bases with their ballistic missiles inside Iraq. Much has been made of the fact that there were no casualties. How much of that has to do with early warning systems, and how much of that has to do with the fact that the Iranians were very wary about crossing Trump's red line, which was harming Americans?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. Likely, it was sort of a demonstration by the Iranian saying, look, we have these missiles. We can reach out and touch where your troops are. And they're so accurate that we can, we're not going to shed blood, but we are going to get your attention. Now, clearly, we had plenty of head start. You know, as tensions ratchet up, we have sensors, you know, in orbit. We have sensors flying, you know, and looking at both the air and the ground, and we have electronic sensors and a variety of capabilities that were just, you know, lighting up the entire western part of Iran. So we knew when the launch was taking place, and we saw them preparing to launch. And so that, of course, gave us plenty of notice. We hustled people to, you know, protective facilities, you know, sent aircraft away and did a variety of things that you would normally do if you're thinking, you know, you're going to come under attack. And, you know, it was successful. All they ended up doing is a little harm to a few, you know, structural facilities, and obviously killed or wounded no one.
To what extent were they symbolic? Because the two bases, one was in Kurdish territory and one, I believe, was in Sunni held territory. I could be incorrect about that second one. There was a closer.
There is an El Anbar province. You're right.
Okay, so there is a base much closer to the Iranian border that they would have been easier to strike. So, is there any symbolism there?
I think so. You know, like I said last weekend, the vote in the parliament was along party lines. The Shia voted to expel the U.S. and the Sunnis and the Kurds stayed at home because they, you know, have good reason to want the U.S. to remain. And, of course, it's a non-binding resolution. So going after the Kurds, that's nothing new for the Iranians. There's plenty of Iranian militia in the north. And then, of course, going after the Sunni, which has always been an antagonist to the Shia, is nothing new either. So I wasn't surprised. And, of course, that's why we have located our personnel in those regions, because it's more friendly to us than the Shia population and much less the Iranians.
I don't know if you're free to speak about this, but to what extent is your day-to-day work now involved with the Iranian situation?
I deal with international security issues all over the world. You know, this would be tangential to the types of things that I would be interested in.
But you're in, I'm guessing, you're in communication, regular communication with colleagues for whom this is sort of central to their present concern.
Yeah. Anytime U.S. forces are engaged in hostile activities, I have a vested interest, and I try to monitor that and have contact with the appropriate people.
When we're going to take a break here in about a minute and a half, and I do want to talk about the downing of the Ukrainian airliner. I just wanted to talk about, we'll start the conversation now and continue it after the break, and that has to do with President Trump's promises to bring troops home. I sincerely believe his base would like him to do that. I believe he would like to do that. He wanted to bring troops home from Afghanistan. He announced it and then did a reversal. What is the situation? The Iraqi parliament has voted. You know, they've asked the United States to pull their troops out. What's going to happen there?
We'll probably stay there for the term, certainly through the election, if not longer. Though I would personally like to see us pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan, there are reasons why, you know, some of the commanders want us to stay at least with a small footprint in Afghanistan, you know, so that we can have an anti-terrorist capability close to the source and to keep the likes of Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others under wraps. And then, of course, in Iraq, just because of ISIS. If ISIS were to disappear tomorrow, then the justification for remaining there would begin to dwindle. So I suspect that there are some preconditions, but I do anticipate the administration would like to get out, but won't accept. We'll downsize both elements. We have about 5,200 in Iraq. You know, right now about 12,000 in Afghanistan. I can see those numbers diminishing in the coming year.
We'll take a quick time out here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio.
Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis is with us. Give me your overall impressions, if you could, on the Iranian shooting down of the Ukrainian airliner, which killed all 176 aboard, including 57 Canadian citizens.
It was interesting that, of course, they lied about it, and then within a few hours, they apologized. That's quite a reversal for a authoritarian regime to do that. But the evidence was incredibly compelling, and, of course, we had shared it with a number of allies and friends that also came to the forefront and announced their concern. You know, it really revealed a lot of Iranian weaknesses, which was, I think, rather embarrassing to the IRGC, much less. You can ask, where in the world was the irregular Iranian army and air defense systems? Evidently, IRGC is all they have. That's quite a revelation, and I would argue the Israelis were salivating at the thought that, you know, maybe this adversary isn't as tough as they've been promoted as being. But the blame is going to come down on the IRGC's Aerospace Force chief. The general will, bite the bullet. And, of course, he's already put out a statement. He said, look, my guys only had 10 seconds to decide to shoot down. And their systems were being jammed, probably by the U.S. And, of course, they never said anything about why they didn't talk to civilian air controllers, which were very close to where this SA-15 was sitting and watching to the west, anticipating an attack from U.S. in response to what, of course, had happened hours before when they sent those rockets at El Assad as well as Erbil. So it's an interesting phenomenon. It's a sad outcome. And of course, it stirred the Iranian people appropriately because almost everybody on there was Iranian in one way or another, at least related to Iranians. And they're calling for major changes. I'm not sure the Ayatollah is going to be removed, but certainly it's going to shake up the IRGC and the Quds Force.
You mentioned that it revealed the weakness of the Iranian air defense system. Is that a direct result, do you believe, of the sanctions?
No. No, I think this is more endemic poor training, poor discipline, poor command and control, poor target identification. They have obviously didn't even understand the flight path of civilian airliners in the vicinity in which they put these SA-15s. Everybody was on high alert. There's no question about it. And they were trigger happy because they fully anticipated an attack. We fooled them. We did not attack. And as a result, some young person probably, in a tense moment, thought that, he better fire, which he did. And once you fire, you can't turn it off. It's not one of those types of systems that you can abort easily, because that's not what the Russians made when they made the SA-15 back in the 70s. So, I think the big winner here, believe it or not, is Israel, because, they, as I indicated, they saw some significant weaknesses in the air defense system of the Iranians. And, of course, your listeners will remember what the Israelis did in 07 against the Syrian reactor and 81 against the Iraqi reactor. And, of course, they're concerned about Iran's flaming accusations that they're going to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, and the whole idea that they might have ballistic missiles and a nuclear weapon to do that, ratchets up the concern in Israel that maybe, we see a vulnerability. Maybe we could, in fact, get in and knock out some of their key sites. After all, what was it, April 18, in which Netanyahu announced to the world the trove of intelligence they scarfed up from a warehouse in Tehran that showed that the Iranians were in fact working on a nuclear program far more advanced than we previously thought. So these things all come to the advantage, I think, of the Israelis. And so they're rather thankful for the revelations that came to bear here in the last week.
It sounds like you're ruling out the possibility that the Iranians shot that airliner down on purpose. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I don't think that they would have done that. In the terrible domestic political situation they have, having killed 1,500 of their own people, I do not see any justification or rationale, even a good conspiracy, as to why. Because there was nobody aboard that was had seniority or an intelligence operative or anything else that has come out to suggest that there would be any nefarious reason to down the aircraft just to get one or a number of people out of the way. So I truly think it ends up being just a terrible, tragic mistake by a poorly coordinated and run air defense system, much like what we saw with the Malaysian airliner in 14, the Russians against the Koreans in 83, and our own mistake against the Iranian aircraft in 88 in the Persian Gulf.
Then what should be the appropriate response to what was an accidental shooting down of a plane in the fog of war, if I can use that that old chestnut? What's the appropriate response?
Well, I think they started, and that is they apologized, which surprised me, and I'm sure a lot of people. They have to pay compensation to the families. They have to obviously demonstrate that they're going to put on trial after the investigation people that they find at fault. If there was gross negligence and there's a crime committed, then the appropriate people should be punished. Certainly heads should roll. You have 176 passengers and crew that are dead as a direct result of this so-called mistake. You just can't tolerate that as a nation. And I think the demonstrations today and over the weekend in Tehran and elsewhere in Iran demonstrate that the Ayatollah is under a lot of heat, and he's going to have to do something to appease that.
There were images coming out of Iran today of Iranian students who refused to walk over the American and Israeli flags that were painted on the sidewalks. Were you heartened by that?
I was. the president, in his speech last Wednesday, the first thing he said when he got up there is, says Iran's never going to have a nuclear weapon while it's on his watch. The last thing that he said is a message to the people of Iran. He says, I want you to have a great future. I want you to embrace peace. And so that was encouraging. And then, of course, earlier today, he sent out a tweet to the Iranian people in Farsi saying, you know, I encourage you to, you know, do the things that will bring, you know, peace to your land. You know, I encourage you to work with your government and, you know, try to resolve the differences, because we as a people can work together. So, you know, I know this must really befuddle the Democrats, who are great, you know, critics of Mr. Trump. But, you know, he's shown incredible restraint over the last week. And here we have, as you indicate, Richard, you know, Iranians are refusing to stamp on our flag and the Israeli flag. And why? Because the enemy is within, not without. And they're beginning to see that. And I think to a certain degree, it's because of the restraint that we've shown.
Robert, we've got about 30 seconds here. I just want to let people know about Future War, The Deeper State, Alliance of Evil, and Progressive Evil. Where can they get a hold of these books?
They're all on Amazon, and I welcome them to, you know, read them and, you know, send me their questions, or we can have a discussion on my Facebook page. It's under my name.
And we've linked up to your Facebook page at strangeplanet.ca conspiracy show. Bob, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Richard.
Open lines are next, and for the full hour, right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away.
Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Hey, thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. A big howdy to each and every one of you who's listening to this program on our flagship station, Zoomer Radio, 740 on the amplitude modulation band and 96.7 on the frequency modulation band here in Toronto. Hiya to those of you tuning in on one of our affiliate stations across North America. And hey, you, streaming us live at zoomerradio.ca or on the Zoomer Radio app. How do to those of you streaming us on the YouTube channel, Strange Planet, and those in the YouTube chat, the live YouTube chat. However, and wherever you're listening, I bid thee the warmest of welcomes, and I thank you for your fine company. Open lines this hour. Open lines. If you want to talk about Iran, and let's face it, that's top of mind for many of us, for most of us, particularly after the shooting down of the Ukrainian airliner as it departed Tehran's airport during the fog of war, if you will, killing all 176 passengers and crew members aboard, including 57 Canadian citizens, many of whom were students and faculty at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. 416-360-0740, and toll free from just about anywhere, 1-866-740-4740. Again, toll free, 1-866-740-4740. Let me just take a moment. I want to thank everyone for all of your wonderful birthday wishes. I spent the better part of the afternoon trying to respond to as many as I could on Facebook and email, and it was very touching. I guess it'll probably, by the time I get finished responding, it'll be time to celebrate my next birthday. I'm doing the best I can. But if you extended birthday greetings and I haven't gotten back to you, I'm trying and I'm kind of digging out from under all of them. And thank you, nonetheless. The mighty Aphrodite asked me, how many candles should I put on the cake? And I said, oh, heck, just turn the, you know, light the whole thing on fire. Oh, my gosh. And if you're, I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but my old high school football jersey had Roman numerals on it. So, no, I'm not that old. Not that old. All right. I wanted to also mention a little programming note. Coming up next week, Andy Thomas. Andy Thomas is one of Britain's more celebrated authors when it comes to this arena of conspiracies and so forth. Andy Thomas will be with us for the first hour, I believe. And I'm sorry. He's going to be with us for the full 2 hours, if I'm not mistaken. And I'll have to check that out. Anyway, Andy Thomas will be with us, and we will be talking about his new book, Conspiracies, the Facts, the Evidence, and the Theories. Or it's the other way around. The Facts, the Theories, and the Evidence. Andy Thomas. Looking forward to that. All right. Let's see. Where are we going here? Do we have a caller on the line? I thought I saw some, but I'm not seeing. Melanie is here from Toronto. Hello, Melanie.
Oh, a blessed new year, and may the Lord be merciful to the souls of the departed and comfort the family. This is, as a Ukrainian person, this wasn't that much of a shock for me, because in the Soviet era, under Stalin and all his henchmen, Beria and all these other mass murderers, they would send out people to the West, and all the expatriates from Ukraine, from Russia and Belarus, who were working against the communist and Soviet regime, they were threatened here, because they would implant their guys who were actually spies, and they played as they were priests, and they were, you know, part of the community, and they weren't. But basically, what they would do is target all the expatriates from the old Soviet Union here in Canada and also in Berlin, and they assassinated a man. So that was part of the fear. So to me, Iran purposely did this not to retaliate against America or Canada. It was directly to warn Iranians who leave Iran and work, for example, do you notice that they were all university professors, professional people, all the elite intelligentsia of the Iranian community outside of Iran? This is a warning to them that, you see, this is what's going to happen to you. And they might have suspected that there was a spy that gave the information as to where their general was going to be, and they just decided to blow up the whole plane because they probably thought that one of those guys was giving the information and heading back to Canada after the general was assassinated. If we look into the list as to who was there, that's going to tell us. That's who they were targeting. This is who the threat is for. It's to threaten Iranians who are going to give information and what they would call traitors to the Iranian regime.
It's worth considering, Melanie. I'll grant you that. But we'd have to listen for more evidence in that regard. And I'm not sure if you heard my interview with Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis.
I'm washing dishes.
Okay. I asked him that very question, you know, whether it was possible. And he just doesn't see the evidence for that.
Well, he could be also saying that. Well, to me, he might be saying that because they're allowing Iran to get away with this one mass murder that they've created against the expatriates, because he doesn't want America to be involved and blamed for anything, and they want to now go into peace and negotiations. So America and American interests cannot say, listen, we know that you were targeting somebody on that plane that gave us the information, because that would give it away. That would give it away where they got all their information and their spy information as to where this general was going to be.
They didn't need that kind of spy information from an Iranian.
Plane. I think somebody on the plane was.
It's worth considering, Melanie.
Yep,
it's worth considering.
Blessed year.
Same to you, Melanie.
Thank you.
I'm going to, you know, as strange as it may sound, I'm going to take the commander of the IRGC at his word on this until further evidence proves otherwise. And I actually, maybe I'm naive, maybe I'm being deceived, but the IRGC commander, who ultimately, you know, the buck stops here, he's responsible. He said, I wish I could die. He feels so horrible about it. He says, I wish I could die. I don't know. There was a real, more than a glimmer of humanity there. So I know it's tempting. And there's a, maybe an urge to want to demonize, and Lord knows there's enough there to demonize. But in this case, I think, you know, the situation is, it's on simmer now. Do we really want to bring it up to a boil and risk it boiling over again? So let's wait and see. It is a couple of things that are rather interesting. One, the Iraqi president, maybe a week before the Iranian shot down the airliner, talked about the 1988 shooting down of the Iranian airliner by the U.S., which was an accident. And let me say, for the record, that so far the Iraqi response, in particular the IRGC commander's response, I wish I could die, was much better than George Herbert Walker's response. I don't know if you recall his response after that horrible, horrible accident. He said, I will not apologize for America. Yikes. Holy smokes. So let's see. Earl is in Oakville this morning. Good morning, Earl. Welcome to the Conspiracy Show.
Hi, Richard. After listening to you speak, I have to think about it. And I think you're right. Maybe it was an accident. It's just that they shouldn't have been there in that airspace at the time, you know?
It could have been an accident. Well, absolutely. There's so many questions. If it was an accident, number one, why wasn't, as Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis just explained, why wasn't the IRGC, this is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, why weren't they in command, or why weren't they in constant contact? They're so close to the airport.
Yeah.
Why weren't they in contact with the civil air authorities saying, you know, who's taking off? Who's landing? Which speaks to incredible ineptitude, obviously, with such tragic results.
Yeah.
And also, as he points out, it shows just how weak the air defense system is in Iran.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You take care, Richard.
Earl, thank you. All the best. Happy New Year.
Bye.
Let's say hello to John, who's checking in from Pittsburgh. John, good morning.
Hi,
welcome to the Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Good, thanks. You?
Terrific. I have to say, I'm very impressed with your city, if I could just take a moment. I took the boys to Pittsburgh this past spring as part of our little baseball tour, my first time there. What a job you people have done. Just a fabulous city.
Well, thank you very much. I like it too, and it's very livable, they say, so it's announced. Hello?
Yeah, what's on your mind, John?
Yes, years ago, Richard, you had an incident, a show on about a vampire that was running through England.
Oh, yes, the Highgate Vampire. Yes.
Okay, what was that about, please, again?
Well, back in the late 60s, true story, 1968, I believe, in Highgate Cemetery, which is in a district of London, there was a series of incidents over a course of several nights. Several animals inside the cemetery and there were several houses that backed, or there's kind of a neighborhood that backs onto the cemetery. People were finding animals, foxes and dogs and so forth, completely drained of their blood. And then there was several witnesses who, when they passed by the gates of the cemetery, they claimed to have seen some strange figure with pale skin and glowing eyes. And people started to panic a little bit. Then there was a woman whose house was adjacent to the Highgate Cemetery. She claimed that she'd been attacked by some figure in her bedroom. And so people started to put all this together. And all of a sudden, you had this hysteria, if I can use that term, taking over. And like a scene out of a Hammer film, you know, Dracula with Christopher Lee, people started marching on the cemetery with torches and so forth, wow, climbing the fence, looking for this, whoever this was responsible. And so it became known as the Highgate Vampire. And then I went to England to investigate, and I met a gentleman who's kind of at the center of this whole legend, because parts of it are, there's some truth to it, but there's also a lot of speculation and legend. This was a gentleman, Archbishop, whose name escapes me now. He claimed to be a descendant of Lord Byron. Anyway, he claimed to have slayed the vampire in Highgate Cemetery. And so I went to his home and I interviewed him, and it was a remarkable story. And in any case, he claimed that he found the, he went down into the sort of the, I guess the mausoleums or underground, and found the coffin containing the vampire, and killed the vampire. Wow. Yeah. If you're interested in, if you go on to, YouTube, most of those episodes for my TV show, The Conspiracy Show, are up there on YouTube. So I would just do a search, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett TV, and or you might look at Richard Serrett Investigates, and there's a whole, all the episodes there pretty well, I think, except for maybe season 4, all there on YouTube, and you can find the episode, or you could go to theconspiracyshow.ca. And that's the website for the TV show. You should be able to find the episode there. Okay. And click on the link. Click on the link for the vampire episode, and it'll take you right there.
Okay. Conspiracyshow.ca.
Yeah. Let me just, while I've got you live on the line here, I'm gonna type it up right here. The Conspiracy Show, just to make sure I'm not giving a, putting you on the wrong track. This is not okay. to be confused with my radio show. Let's see, try.com. .ca, what's happening here? The Conspiracy Show. Oh, isn't that funny? Anyway, I'm not seeing it, but just go search it on YouTube.
Okay, excellent.
All right.
Well, happy
thanks
birthday,
for checking,
Richard. Great show. Listen to you when I can and get you in the area here.
Oh, it's terrific. Are you listening on 740?
Oh, yes. Every night between
listening
to Ziggy and Frank Proctor. And yes.
Well, that's the power of what we call a clear channel license. It's 740, AM 740, the largest
Love
broadcast
it.
Footprint in North America.
Love it.
All right, my friend. Thanks for checking
Thanks,
in from Pittsburgh.
Richard.
All the best.
Uh-huh.
416-360-0740. 416-360-0740. And toll-free 1-866-740-4740. Use the toll-free number just like John from Pittsburgh, and you can call in, and you won't pay a dime. 1-866-740-4740. I thought we would go to the YouTube live stream chat and take a couple of questions. And You Betcha, who joins us every week without fail, You Betcha says, happy birthday, Richard. You don't look a day older than 30. All right. Thank you. You Betcha. The check is in the mail. Duchess 80. Oh, Duchess 80. Is she new? Are you new, Duchess 80? I don't remember seeing you in the chat before. She says, ask him, Richard, if he thinks the general was the mastermind of the Benghazi riot and subsequent murder of Ambassador Stevens. Great question. Great question. I wish I'd known that earlier, and I would have asked Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis that question. To what extent was Suleiman involved in Benghazi and the death of the murder of Ambassador Stevens? All right. And then you betcha, oh, back, you betcha's back again. What's your take on this Amber Alert given this false alarm this morning? Wow. For those of you who are outside the greater Toronto area, many of us on our smartphones received this Amber Alert. Luckily, I had my phone muted, but those who didn't got a startling early morning wake up. And this was from the Darlington nuclear plant. And it turned out to be a false alarm. And we actually know someone who works at Darlington or Pickering. Anyway, it was a mistake. It was an accident. But now I'm hearing, the rumor mill again. There's no evidence for this. I'm just saying what's out there in the social media world and so forth, that somehow the Iranians hacked into it. I've not seen any evidence of that. However, we'll wait and see. But no, there's nothing happening at Darlington. Nuclear power remains safe. And just a quick aside on nuclear power. I know, I've talked in the past about Fukushima and Chernobyl and so forth, but by and large, no question, nuclear power has proven to be the safest form of energy ever in history. I don't know why the climate alarmists, on the one hand, are saying, you have to stop using fossil fuel. And then we say, okay, fine. How about nuclear? That's been proven to be successful. No, you can't do that either. Oh, so we're to rely then on wind and solar. We're going to freeze. Do you know how many millions of people would perish every year without fossil fuels? Which leads me to the conclusion that climate change is not the existential threat. It's climate alarmists. Let's say hi to Mike in Mississauga. Mike, good morning.
Hi there, Richard. How are you?
I'm well. Yourself?
Not bad, thank you. Great show as always. Great topics and great work on filling it coast to coast. Really great. I'll keep this quite short. I was listening a little bit off and on the Roy Green show today on 6:40 a.m. and same topic. And he had a gentleman on, an official, who mentioned that on this particular flight that the Ukrainian plane took, there was exactly several flights, exact same pattern and flight that they all know their protocol and were taken prior to the Ukrainian flight. And something called, I think, the FDM or whatnot. It's a flight path that the pilots take and all the rest of it. So when I heard that, I thought to myself, those first seven flights that got through before the Ukrainian flight, was there at least one American on board? Because Trump said one American casualty, one structure, we're going to come very hard down on the Iran nation. So I was just wondering if once they comb and peel back the onions and they find out from those first seven flights if there was at least one American on that flight, and then they found out that on the eighth flight there were no Americans, that might have been the target. That's what I thought about.
That's interesting. Well, then that demands, more investigation, Mike. So thank you for bringing that to our attention, which would, suggest the possibility that it might have been deliberate. Got to go to a break, Mike, but thank you for that update.
Much,
all right, all the best. Back with more open lines here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away.
Question everything. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio.
Hey, welcome back. Open lines. Geez, another year older and I'm starting to lose it already. Final glide pattern. a couple of corrections. First of all, I gave you a programming note and I gave you the wrong programming that's coming up next week. It's not Andy Thomas on conspiracies. That will be Sunday, January 26th. That's in 2 weeks. And that'll be for the full 2 hours. He's the author of, he's a British author, very well known in this arena over there. Conspiracies, the facts, the theories, the evidence. That's in 2 weeks. Next week, it'll be author Dylan Howard. And he's written a book on Jeffrey Epstein called Dead Men Don't Lie. That's the first hour. Dylan Howard next week on Jeffrey Epstein, Dead Men Don't Lie. That's item number one on the programming side. The other one is John from Pittsburgh called in earlier, and I was trying to direct him to where he could find an old TV episode I did on the Highgate Vampire. And the website for the TV show is still up and available. This is for the Conspiracy Show, the TV show, not to be confused with this radio program. And it's theconspiracyshow.com, theconspiracyshow.com. And if you go there and just click on episodes, and you'll see the vampire episode is season one, episode 12. And underneath it says view. Just click on it and you can watch it right there on YouTube. It'll take you right there. Okay, John in Pittsburgh. Hope that helps. And for all of you fans of the my old TV show, seasons one, two, and three, all available. Oh, and season four. Just seasons one, two, and three so far. Those are all available to view. And again, you just go to theconspiracyshow.com and click on episodes, find the one you want to watch and click on it. There you go. All right. Let's see. Who is up next? Tim is in Newmarket. Tim, good morning. Yeah. Welcome to the Conspiracy Show.
I'm a first-time caller.
Hey, welcome aboard. Thank you.
Okay. I would like to talk about the passing of one of the greatest Canadians of all time, and that is Neil Peart of Rush. He was my idol. I've seen him 13 times, and I've been in the music business for over 40 years. And my heart is very heavy, as is all the Rush fans. And, of course, the Lee family, the Lifeson family, the Peart family, the Underlinger family, which is the lighting director for Rush. And this guy was just synonymous with excellence in everything he did. I watched him with binoculars. I've seen this guy drum, and I've seen some of the best drummers in the world in my 60 years of living. And I can't tell you how sad I am, and the people of Newmarket and Canada and all around the world that had the pleasure of being exposed to the band Rush and the awesome, awesome drumming and lyricist abilities of Mr. Neil Peart.
Yes. Admittedly, I was not a huge Rush fan. When I was in high school, I had a couple of friends that were huge Rush fans, like yourself. One in particular, Paul, if you're listening in Brantford, Paul Bund, has a shrine in his house, and he would travel around like the Deadheads used to, following the Grateful Dead. He would follow a Rush around and see them wherever and whenever he could. And when I would go to a house party, and if he was in charge of the turntable, he'd have Two Hemispheres on there playing Moving Pictures and all of their albums. Even though I was not a huge fan, I could certainly appreciate and admire and respect the technical acumen of this gentleman. And my understanding is that Neil Peart, I mean, just the drum kit was immense. The physicality involved in playing that huge drum kit, the amount of energy and strength that would be required, he must have been absolutely exhausted and drained and in pain after every show.
Well, I'm not going to even come close to say that I'm even near the level of Neil Peart, but examining his body of work, which I have. If you are a musician, maybe you will understand more. Do you play an instrument?
No. My children play piano.
But the connection always was with the musicians first, and other fans that didn't play instruments, like Dave Grohl, for example, from the Foo Fighters, and drummers like this. He was at a level of precision and speed and, like you said, acumen and timing And like he used to throw the drumsticks 15, 20 feet in the air from a sitting position, you know, and catch it. And I used to watch him with binoculars, and there was no like a laughing face or, you know, this guy was deadly serious. And I know that people all over Canada and are at this point very heartbroken, and we really lost a true superstar as a person and as a Canadian. And I
agree. Eternal be his memory.
And always, it will never die as long as I'm alive. And as long as there's people that want to do the air drumming, like people would air drum at the concerts.
I'll bet. Yeah, he was a drummer's drummer. Some guitarists are, you know, they're considered a guitarist, as you say, because they're appreciated by fellow musicians. One of the things I also learned about Neil Peart, not surprisingly, was, you know, he was influenced by the jazz drummers like Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich. And you could tell. Because he brought that to the fore with, even though, you know, he's playing in this amazing prog rock band,
exactly.
he infused, you know, Krupa and all of these jazz drummers from the past.
Now, Buddy Rich, this is the type of guy Buddy Rich was. He had open heart surgery and was told never to drum again. And he played Ontario Place 6 months after open heart surgery. And I watched the show, and he had a big, thick sweater on. Now, could you imagine the heat from the lights and the?
I couldn't imagine. You
know, yeah,
I do remember. I remember as a young boy watching Buddy Rich on the Tonight Show,
right?
And he was a funny guy too. He'd come, he'd sit down, he would joke, he would tell stories, and then he'd walk over to the drum kit on the band, and I was just mesmerized by his ability. And yet, you're right, the sweat pouring down. And he was in his late 70s at that time.
Yes.
Just the conditioning
it's quite
of the drummer.
It's an instrument to play. And in Canada, for some reason, we have the best musicians, and they're treated not very well by the government or not very well by the people, really, until they're gone or they have to work so hard to get somewhere, and I would like to see that hopefully change for the younger musicians coming up the pipe, because it's very hard, and it's a very hard, you know, like AC/DC says, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll, and I've been trying a long, long time, but
I like
basically,
this guy, Richard.
I appreciate you listening to me, and long live Neil Peart, and long live Getty and Alex, and all the fans. God bless Neil.
Tim, thank you so much.
Thanks.
You've brought Neil Peart closer to the heart. All right. Do we have time for one more Owen back in studio before we break? I got one time. Well, Owen says yes, so let's go for it. Tony's in Toronto. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning. I want to just talk about Iran, and I hope that the recent events and the tragedy won't lead to reestablishment of diplomatic relationship between Canada and Iran again. There are people, I understand, that are actually drooling to see that happen. I hope that that will never happen. That's all I want
to say. You're hoping that this airliner being shot down doesn't lead to Canada severing diplomatic ties,
event,
if I'm hearing you correctly.
And the now that the Canadian consulars are trying to get to Iran, and it won't lead to reopening of the Iranian embassy in Canada and vice versa.
Reopening. I didn't know. Don't we have diplomatic relations with Iran?
No, we don't.
We don't?
No.
All right.
Yeah, Harper so rightfully cut it off. And I'm sure that liberals are some of them, actually, at least, are drooling for that moment to undo what Harper did. And that's a disservice to the Iranian people and Canadian interest. That's all I want to say.
Tony, may I ask, are you from Iran?
Yes.
You are. When did you leave?
When
did you come to Canada? Yes, when did you come to Canada?
Around 86.
So 7 years after the revolution?
Yes.
How did you get out?
Oh, well, it's a long story, and I'm a last caller. It's I had to get to the border and fled. That's all.
Tony, can I get you to hold on? Because I'd like to talk to you for some. Would you hold on during the break?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you so much. Tony, expat from Iran who escaped in 1986, and we'll chat some more on the other side. The Conspiracy Show, open lines, get on board. 416-360-0740, toll free from out of town, 1-866-740-4740.
Shaking the world and seeing what falls. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Tony is with us. He held on during the break. Tony escaped Iran in 1986, 7 years after the Islamic Revolution, found his way to Canada. And as Tony correctly pointed out, something I wasn't aware of, and that is that we have not had formal diplomatic relations with Iran since 2012. For some reason, I was under the mistaken impression that after the Iran nuclear agreement in the summer of 2015, that we reinstated diplomatic relations, but it's not true. What we did do was we lifted most of the economic sanctions against Iran. Tony is back with us. Tony, you somehow made it to the border and were able to make it to Canada.
Yes.
Are you still with us? Right.
Yes.
And what else can you tell us about your struggle to get here?
Oh, well, back then, there was a, under Maroni, there was a program called Iranian Special Program. Which was designed to attract those who have some qualification. It's not that I'm saying that I was qualified enough or I was better than the rest. No. There was some criteria set up, and the Canadian embassy in neighboring countries, such as in my case, Turkey. Would accept applications for Iranians to come to Canada,
and right.
From that route, I that was the path that I took.
And do you still have family in Iran?
My family are diminishing as to the age. My parents have died, and distant families I have. Not very close families, no.
No, but I mean, do you have contact with anyone in Iran?
Oh yes, of course, yes.
And what do they tell you, for example, right now on the ground with the student protesting and the 1,500 protesters that have been killed? What is your sense of the situation, the domestic political scene in Iran? Is there any chance that there will be a huge uprising and that the mullahs will be forced to flee the country?
Oh, yes. The whole thing is very ready for a final uprising. It all depends on a foreign understanding, not necessarily foreign aid or intervention. Intervention is the very last thing that Iranian people want. During Obama's administration, there was a green movement, if you remember.
Yes.
and Obama didn't move, didn't do anything for those who participated in that uprising. That opportunity was lost during Obama time, and we hope.
What could President Trump do if the people of Iran decide once again to take to the streets en masse? Mm-hmm. What could the Trump administration do to assist them, short of, you know, military aid?
Oh well, this is the thing. The sanctions have to be meaningful. And it's number one. Number two is he has to make sure that he put ultimate pressure on Iranian agents who have been deployed outside in North America in huge numbers. The name of your show is Conspiracy Thing, and if I say that there are sleeper cells in Canada, you say, oh, this guy is talking.
Oh, no, I have no doubt, Tony. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt that there are sleeper cells here.
So the first sign he has to show is to kick out those people who are sent by the government. And presently, they live and work in the United States. They hold high positions, academics and businessmen, and they are fully connected to the government of Iran. That's the first thing that he has to do. He has to.
Okay. Tony, I have about a minute here, so I want to ask you a couple of quick questions. One, how did you feel when you saw here in Toronto Iranians protesting, or Iranian Canadians, and not only just Iranian Canadians, other Canadians protesting at the U.S. Embassy for the targeting of Soleimani?
I'm telling you, I don't know about the other nationals, but the ones the Iranians, those Iranians who go and oppose these things, these are the ones that I'm talking about. Those are the ones that they have received the order from Tehran to show up. Those are the ones. And this is my thing. Liberals don't have the guts to do anything about those people. There are liberals who are drooling to go soft on Iran and Iranian
Tony,
regime.
Yes. Tony, I thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
You took me. Bye-bye.
All right. Great call. We'll take one final timeout, come back, and I'll continue to take your calls until we decide to dim the lights here and say goodnight for another week. Stay with us right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett.
Don't be afraid of the dark. Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To talk to Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Welcome back. Let's go to Richmond, Virginia and say hi to Gabriel. Gabriel, welcome aboard.
Hello, Richard. Can you hear me clearly?
I can. How are you picking us up tonight?
I just like to check out the AM radio stations and see what's going on, but I was very curious to know what your show was about when I heard about conspiracy theories.
Oh, so you're listening to us on AM 740?
Yes, I am.
Way down in Virginia. There you go. Earlier we heard from Pittsburgh. It's always nice to hear, you know, how far the signal is extending and how are we coming in down there?
It's okay. I decided I'd go onto the website as well so I could stream it.
There you go. All right, Gabriel, what's on your mind tonight?
Well, I'm just curious to know. Maybe I could ask you a couple questions about it and get your opinion. I kind of wanted to go back to the subject of climate change, if that was all right.
Sure.
Yeah, so I'm just curious to know if it seems that we're getting, you know, in all these different forms of media, you know, super big example, you know, being TED Talks. I've seen it dominating that YouTube channel, all these TED Talks about climate change, as well as, you know, I don't know if you've looked into the IPCC report, which was released by the United Nations, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I'm just wondering if all of these, and I understand that you were saying that the real problem is the climate alarmist as opposed to the, you know, issue of climate change itself. I'm just wondering what your opinion would be. I mean, all these sources of authority seem to be telling us that there is a very significant issue that's happening. And it, you know, to me, you know, from what I've seen and just what I've observed, it seems to be that the real conspiracy is that we've had this information for such a long time and have failed to act on it. And, you know, it seems like big corporations are, you know, paying a small group of people to spread misinformation or cause, you know, cause confusion or, you know, doubt that climate change is, you know, happening at the rate that it's happening.
Well, show me where is the evidence that climate change is happening at this, you know, aside from, you know, anecdotal evidence about extreme weather, which is a constant. You know, where is the evidence? Where is the data? If you mentioned the IPCC report, if you go to, I believe it's chapter 9, it says right there, their models, their computer models have demonstrated that they can't project outwards in terms of predicting climate. It's right there in the IPCC report.
Well, and I think that the reason for that, and I think that the IPCC report is actually a very conservative report in regards to climate change, because Most of the things that you're trying to measure when you're talking about a global scale of events, you're not able to quantify it with absolute certainty. We're not going to be able to say with a, you know, less than a 1%, you know, range of certainty what's going to happen because it's such a big problem. But there are well-known effects that are being caused by climate change that I feel like are worth, you know, looking into. I mean, I encourage all of your listeners to look into these effects and see, you know, for themselves, the studies that have been done on them. You know, for one example, what I've looked into is like the albedo effect, which is the idea that when the sun is our sun's rays are reflected from the ice and the polar ice caps. So the energy is shot back into the sky because of the white ice, you know, reflecting it back into the atmosphere. But while the ice is being melted, we have darker water as our surface area, which instead is increasing the temperature even more. That's just one of the effects that I find a little alarming.
The effect of climate. Yes, the climate changes. The question at hand is it anthropogenic climate change? Are we contributing to it? Perhaps. Right. But let me. That's you mentioned why, ice. Okay. So let me just mention this: the Arctic ice. 6,000 years ago, the Arctic was ice-free, carbon dioxide levels less than 300 parts per million. How do we explain that?
Right. And I understand, but you said if the problem is anthropogenic, and we actually live in a geological age known as the Anthropocene, which I'm looking it up right now in the dictionary, just making sure I say it right. Anthropocene, the definition is relating or denoting the current geological age viewed as the period during which human activity has become the dominant influence on climate and the environment. So this is actually the geological age that we live in, known as the Anthropocene.
Okay, no, that's interesting, but that's called arguing from authority. If I say, well, so-and-so said this, that doesn't mean, you know, that's the case. You know, the other thing that we hear constantly is about the rising ocean levels. I walked into a high school open house. I'm shopping around for a high school for my boys. I walked into the geography department, and they had all these posters on the wall, you know, about all of these islands are going to disappear. And, you know, rising ocean levels, and we've been hearing about this for forever. The ocean levels have been rising at about 2.75 millimeters per year since Abraham Lincoln was president. It's been constant, it's been predictable, it's been slow and steady. There's no evidence you know, that the ocean levels are rising at an alarming rate. None whatsoever. And I have yet to see any evidence that carbon dioxide is driving temperature. None. I mean, if anything, it seems to be, if you look at the geological record, it seems to be a lagging indicator. We see periods when the temperature goes up, then carbon dioxide levels rise, rather than the other way around. So we haven't even figured that out, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can tell, looking at the data. I've yet to see any evidence that proves carbon dioxide drives temperature. And that's the key. Until they can show that, I don't think it's worth spending trillions of dollars shutting down entire industries, putting millions of people's lives at risk. What's killing, you know, millions of people? We have Greta Thunberg saying, oh, you know, millions of people are dying because of climate change. No, millions of people are dying every year around the world because of energy poverty, because they can't heat their homes with affordable and safe, you know, oil furnaces and natural gas. What are they using? They're burning dung and wood inside their houses, and they're dying from, you know, from respiratory ailments. 4 million people a year die from energy poverty. That is the problem. Africa, look what's happening in that. We could lift Africa, or Africans could lift themselves out of poverty if they had the advantages of an industrial revolution, if they had access to cheap, affordable energy. That's what's putting lives at risk, not climate change. It's denying technology to people that need it.
I'm curious to know, I'll ask you, would you happen to know, I mean, how much oil is there left to use? Is it even a viable source of energy that we would be able to cultivate for a sustainable amount of time?
Well, I don't know, but, you know, I'm not saying that we're going to be on oil for the rest of our lives. We certainly, yes. I'm all for looking for other sources of energy. You know, nuclear. We're shutting down nuclear plants at our peril. We shut them down in this province at our peril. You know, why aren't we looking at nuclear energy? Why are the environmentalists so dead set against nuclear, and yet we can't have fossil fuels? Imagine, you know, what would happen in a climate like North America without access to fossil fuels? And they want to shut all of that down by what, 2030? It's a pipe dream. It's never going to happen.
I completely agree with you. That's why I'm trying to get to the bottom of this and really understand the situation at hand, because I feel, you know, either way, whichever way you look at it, I mean, I don't think that it would not be an easy change. I'm 100% in agreement with you. I mean, we're talking about a complete change in the lives of, I'm sure, you know, the entire Canadian population as well as the American population, if we were to, you know, change our reliance from fossil fuels to another form of energy. I'm in complete agreement with that.
It would be cataclysmic. It would be cataclysmic. And the key to all this, because it's not about the climate, it's not about the environment, it's about control. Their solution is give us the authority and we'll solve the problem. When has government ever solved a problem? In Canada, they sell marijuana and they're losing money. Only a government could sell drugs and lose money. Are we really going to trust them to solve our energy problems? Gabriel, apologies. I got to run. We're out of time. Great hearing from you. I hope you'll call again and we can continue this conversation.
Thank you, Richard. You have a good night.
All the best. All right. My thanks to Owen and Ryan and to all of you for listening. Back next week with a brand new program. We'll talk Jeffrey Epstein with an author who's written a book called Dead Men Don't Lie. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.